Session number 22675, Rule 4.
There's crowd in Rule 4.
There was a very important medical team there, and their senior officer was in fact a brigadier. There were surgeons on the spot, and they carried out all kinds of operations, even amputations behind this hill. By then, the Gurkhas had arrived, and it was their baptism with fire. And when Gurkhas first came into action, they never brought a weapon, only their cookery. And so they were always very brave and always efficient at fighting. But on this occasion, they were there to help carry the wounded out and to bury our dead, which was also done to a certain extent by the Royal Artillery, who'd moved up to join us at the non-sharp end of the hill. And when we went there, there were quite a few trees on this hill. At the end of the day, I don't think there was a single tree that survived completely, because the artillery used to fire through the till at the Japanese, who were then entrenched in a small way on the end of the hill where this man won the VC. And we were shelled every day without fail by these long-range guns in the hill. And the only time we got in relief when we had something to eat or a mess full of tea was when one of our spotter planes went up and to find out where the guns were. The guns stopped firing then for obvious reasons, and we were able to do what was necessary, have a quick wash and or have something to eat or go to the toilet. The toilet was the hill, and all you had to wipe your bottom on was grass. And so that was always risky, using the toilet. You go just one side of the hill and do it as quick as you could, covered by your men, and get back as quick as possible. Incidentally, things got really difficult, and at one point the RAF came back. We couldn't get them the day we wanted them, of course. They came the next day, and I was looking up my trench, and there were all these hurry bombers going in to hit the Japs on our very own hill. And suddenly I thought, what was leaflets coming down? And I said to my section, what the hell are they dropping leaflets for? It wasn't a leaflet. They weren't leaflets. It was one of the Air Force planes which had been hit by small arms fire and exploded and came down in small pieces. And we decided then and then, or the command officer did, that one of the many Japanese swords we were to capture would be delivered to the pilot's family, which apparently was done. Now, it came to the last day, and on that last day, it was then the job of my troop, which was 4 Troop 5 Commando, to be at the sharp end. We didn't know it was going to end that day, but it did. And a sergeant major from another troop had been to a village and got enough eggs to send us up 2 boiled eggs each, the first kind of almost hot meal we'd had. And some of my colleagues now in my commando can't believe it, but it did happen. And not only that, the mail came up, and you've got a pile of mail. We were in trenches which belonged to another troop, and there wasn't enough room for us. And we were shoulder to shoulder that night and the next day. And the mail came up, and you got a pile of mail. You went through it. Oh, he's dead. Put his at the bottom. Go through it and pick out your own. There might be 3 letters for you. And one of the letters told me that my home, my parents' home, they were both now dead, had been a V2 rocket had landed 5 doors away, cut the bedrooms off, the rest of it was wrecked. Fortunately, my wife had gone back to Falmouth to her mother, so she was all right. And my brother lived next door, and he'd taken his family to Wales the day before and decided to stay a day, because when he got back, American forces who were based in Bushy Park and Hurst Park Racecourse in Molesey were there looking for him. And he came back and found they were digging for him, because a brother-in-law of mine who lived nearby said my brother-in-law should be in there, and that's why they're digging for him. So that was that. So
what was the address of the house that was hit by the V2?
It was 5 doors up, and my house was 46 Pemberton Road, so it would have been 46, 48... 54 Pemberton Road, and there were 7 people in a shelter, and it landed right by it, and the lot were killed. But I don't think there were any other casualties, but it ruined 3 roads, Dennis Road, Pemberton Road, Mine Road, and Park Road, and houses were wrecked in all three roads. So there I was at the sharp end, and I was a Lance Sergeant, and Lance Sergeant probably wasn't the best rank to be, because you had to be where the action was with your section. The full sergeant got behind the two Lance Sergeant sections, and the officer behind him, although they were all pretty close to the action. And one or two chaps had tried to go forward. Each one was killed. One was just in front of my trench, and he got a bullet just for the side of his nose, which had gone through the back of his head. And when I turned him over, there was quite a gap in the back of his head. And so he was pulled aside off the track. There was only a track to get to the enemy, and they were at the end of the hill. And I saw four Japanese moving out, giving a bandy chair to another Japanese who must have been an officer. And I couldn't understand that, because we were always taught the Japanese prefer to die in action, not be wounded, because they thought they were going to the promised land. And everyone was killed, had his name inserted on a piece of rice paper, which was placed in a cathedral in Tokyo. Anyway,
what were they giving to the officer?
A bandy chair, you know, like we used to give as kids. Somebody else would stand there, like you, and we would grip hands, and that formed a chair, which they set him on. I fired a whole round of a whole case of Tommy gun ammunition at them. I don't know whether I hit them, because they were moving into the bush there. But then it was my turn to move forward, and I was extremely lucky, because in fact they pulled out. And when I got there, there were dead Japanese with our commandos in trenches, many Japanese wearing green berets, which they'd taken off our chaps. I found one live Japanese soldier, which I didn't shoot. Several people wanted to, but I propped him up against a tree and warned them not to shoot him. He might have been useful for information, which is why we took Japanese prisoners of war. And then I found a naval officer alive in a trench, wounded. And it soon transpired he was a naval op, you know, directing naval gunfire onto the Japanese at the end of the hill. And when I dragged him out, it came, and when he found out who we were, I said, "Five Commando." He said, "I was a naval op in the war in Madagascar with you." And, you know, it was quite remarkable. Anyway, we tidied everything out, got the wounded back, got the dead back to be buried by other people, and secured at the end of the hill, and the Japs had disappeared. And about 2 hours later, Indian troops, thank God, had arrived to relieve us. We moved off the hill, had a service for the dead and wounded in a paddy field, directly we got off, and then moved back to the beach, and was conveyed back to India. Oh no, before we went, all kinds of people turned up. Lord Louis Mountbatten turned up. Lady Mountbatten came on another place, on another plane, and three generals turned up. Two orders of the day were issued, which I can show you if you want to see them, about our battle, complimenting us. And we were then told that we were going on leave, and we could choose anywhere in India, because of the fight we put up, to go on leave. And the wounded were taken out to the hospital ship, and as I say, we were sailed back to India, and that was the last time we saw action, except we were then told we were preparing for the battle in Malaya against the Japanese, of course, who were still there, and we did some more training, and we were going by train to Bombay to board a ship to go down there. We would go through the Malacca Straits and then do a landing, which was going to be a pretty tough one. But then the war ended. When the atom bombs dropped, the Japs gave up. We were told the war was over. We all went out and fired our weapons into the air in the excitement. We all got a drink from somewhere. But we still had to go through with the Malayan operation, in that we had to go to the railway station. We had to go into Bombay. We had to board a ship, which took to sea, but they didn't know where to take us because the war was over. We went down to Ceylon for 2 days swimming. We then suddenly set sail, went through the Malacca Straits, and we were going round to Hong Kong because the Japanese were still there. And when we got there, the Navy were there, of course, but no British troops were there. We landed, and the Japanese were still firing from the rooftop. They soon stopped that. We rounded them up, Several have bought civilian suits to disguise themselves, but they were recognisable. By then, we learnt the difference between the Japanese and the Chinese. Rounded them all up and put them all in prison camps. And I was left in charge for a short time in charge of a prison camp. Then moved into a house, my headquarters, where the adjutant had accidentally locked the keys in the safe. I had to go down to, by then we're in Kowloon, I had to go down to a market in Kowloon and find a safecracker, which I did. Sat with him till 1 o'clock in the morning, because that was the time he eventually got it open, to make sure he didn't pinch anything. Because the Chinese philosophy was, if you left something, they thought it was for them. And then one morning, somebody arrived from the orderly room and said, I had the choice of taking Japanese prisoner of war back to Japan, which I always wished to have done, or go home. I chose to go home and was taken home on a British aircraft carrier. By then I was RSM, and that meant I had the privilege of meeting in the CPO's mess, where I qualified for a rum ration. And when they had their rum ration, everyone was talking like mad because of the rum. Always had a super meal, had a sleep, went on deck every morning, every afternoon at 4 o'clock to take on the Royal Navy at deck hockey on the flight deck. Which we never ever beat them, because they were so used to it. We tried very hard. And then we ended up back in Gurok, and then went back home to our wives and families. I went straight back to Falmouth, where my wife still was, and then we came up to where our home was, and were awarded a wonderful prefab to live in. And that's why I'm in here, which was a council house originally, but which I eventually bought at reduced rates, of course, because I had a lot of service in council property by then. So that's the end of my story.
What did you think of the Japanese enemy after you'd fought them?
I hated them and still hate them for that day for several reasons. One was that one of my friends, one of my colleagues, who was a private, was lying wounded and had his head lopped off by a Japanese sword. Now, I don't know whether it was an officer or a warrant officer, but I've hated them ever since and would never drive a Japanese car, for example. And couldn't really stand it when my daughter, when she was about seven, fell in love with the Japanese. I think it was the way they dressed. But, you know, she liked them. I never did. I never will. They were very cruel.
How do you feel now about having served with Five Commando in the war?
Very proud. I've just had it. We still got a new... Oh.
Has it left you with any...
Still got a newsletter, which arrived today, a Commando newsletter.
This is the Commando Association.
Yeah. And I still get a troop newsletter. A Five Commando newsletter.
Did your service in the war leave you with any long-term effects?
No effects at all. And I can't understand nowadays why people fighting in these short wars are affected so much. I just can't understand it. But it helped me get a job. I told you I don't know whether I did tell you, but the day my mail arrived in Hill 170, I was doing a correspondence course. It was one of the big correspondence schools who had offices in Bombay. And believe it or not, I had papers that day. And I eventually answered them on the hill by getting a paper from the orderly room. Used to take a tin box. Getting a piece of paper from that tin box and an envelope, and doing the papers and sticking them together with slivers of bamboo. You know, I didn't have any paper clips or anything, and managed to put them in the commando post box. So, you know, it's quite ridiculous, really, that I was doing on the correspondence, of course, on this ghastly hill. But, you know, it's a real fight for 10 days, and reckoned by some to be one of the fiercest battles in Burma, and that includes Imphal, which was very harsh, yeah. I was very fond of the Isle of Wight, and because my wife was living in East Molesey then, at that time, before she joined me, I used to get home every weekend and without a pass. And I used to come by train to Woking, where there were always military police, but they always let me through without question, and then I get another train to Hersham and walk from Hersham to West Molesey. And when I went back Sunday evening, I get down to Portsmouth in time to catch the early morning boat, which took the papers, milk and post over. And I used to get back to my billet for breakfast, which was always a very nice breakfast. And I've just remembered that.
When you were in Burma, did you ever come across the Indian forces who defected to the Japanese?
No, we never come across them. But when we were up at Imphal, that was, well, not at Imphal, at Silchar in the northeast, that was going to be one of the problems. If the Japanese army got into India proper, they would get lots of support from a lot of Indians. But no, they were not allowed to fight those people that defected to the Japanese. They just give some other support, perhaps as coolies or something as low as that. But no, we never saw them. But that was the danger, that a lot of them, thousands of them, would side with the Japanese.